Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Erie et al. Titled, Cardiac Sympathetic Innervation via Middle Cervical and Stellate Ganglia and Antirhythmic Mechanisms of Bilateral Stellectomy. This article published March 1, 2017. Joining me today are Associate Editor Mario Del Mar, Lead Author Marmar Vasegi, and Content Expert Crystal Ripplinger. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara, and hello, everyone. Today, we are discussing a very interesting and, in my opinion, rather impactful paper on the role of sympathetic innervation of aponeurysmogenesis in a porcine model of myocardial infarction. The results, I think, make a very strong case for the idea that bilateral sympathetic denervation can have a profound antiarrhythmic effect, particularly in the setting of chronic myocardial infarction. And I think that this is a conclusion that can have important potential translational implications. So, Marmar, why don't you take us briefly through the background and the main findings of the paper?
Thank you, Mario. The reason we embarked on this endeavor was that we initially started noticing that in our patients with very refractory recurrent ventricular arrhythmias and ICD shocks, that doing a thoracic epidural anesthesia seemed to calm everything down. And they were then able to be bridged to transplant or a VT ablation procedure because they were no longer in incessant VT or having recurrent ICD shocks to a point where we couldn't even take them to the catheterization laboratory. We first started looking at the effect of bilateral cardiac sympathetic denervation in a normal porcine hearts. And we really just wanted to see acutely if you decentralized the stellate ganglion and took out the T2 thoracic ganglia, which are the ganglia that have a lot of cardiac sympathetic neurons, if that caused hemodynamic instability and what effects it had in terms of just global action potential duration. What we found is that doing bilateral cardiac sympathetic innervation in normal hearts actually didn't really cause any significant blood pressure or heart rate effects. We decided to test the hypothesis of, now, does cardiac sympathetic innervation reduce VT, VF inducibility, and what are the antiarrhythmic mechanisms in infarcted hearts? What we found is that in infarcted hearts, middle cervical ganglia stimulation actually had even more powerful effects than stellate ganglia stimulation, suggesting that there was enough remodeling in the middle cervical ganglia from the infarction that the sympathetic innervation was even more powerful. Once we took out the stellate ganglia and the thoracic ganglia and we did the cardiac sympathetic denervation procedure, the innervation from the middle cervical ganglia remained intact. But surprisingly, there was a small increase in activation recovery interval, which we had not seen in normal hearts. And there seemed to be changes in terms of what we consider to be surrogates of arrhythmogenesis. So T-peak TN interval, which is an independent marker of sudden cardiac death in patients, as well as dispersion of repolarization, which is really just a surrogate for how much variability we have in our APDs across the myocardium. In addition to this, the most powerful finding of the paper, I think, was that in the same animal, pre-cardiac sympathetic denervation as compared to post-cardiac sympathetic denervation, there was a significant reduction in VT-VF inducibility. So in a paired analysis, half the animals that had been inducible prior to bilateral cardiac sympathetic denervation were no longer inducible afterwards.
So these are quite remarkable findings. And I wonder, Crystal, if you could give us a word on what do you think would be the mechanisms by which this stimuli are changing dispersion of repolarization? And maybe give us just a quick word on dispersion of repolarization and its importance in arrhythmogenesis.
Thank you, Mario. So dispersion of repolarization is often used as a marker of arrhythmogenesis because increases in dispersion of repolarization are associated with unidirectional conduction blocks. So what we mean by that is when you have a repolarization wavefront that's not necessarily uniform and it's spreading more heterogeneously across the heart, you're more likely for a subsequent wavefront to hit an area of refractory tissue and propagate in one direction and not the other, which is unidirectional conduction block. And this really sets the stage for the creation of spiral waves and reentrant arrhythmias. What is likely going on is that acutely the distribution of active cardiac nerves is likely being changed. So the acute beta adrenergic stimulation that the myocardium is seeing is likely altered in ways that at this point are still quite unpredictable, which is why studies like these are so important. But what we don't know, and what might be also very important, is how the myocardium changes long term after this procedure, because we know that changes to innervation, whether hyperinnervation or denervation, can also lead to remodeling of the myocardium. So there may be additional benefits that occur over a longer time scale as the myocardium then adapts to this change in sympathetic input.
I think that's a very interesting point, and I wonder if, Marmar, you would comment on the possible long-term changes in the regulation of the inotropic response resulting from the denervation.
We don't have, obviously, long-term studies of bilateral cardiac sympathetic denervation and its effects on VT, VF in large animal models. But we do have now that data in human beings where this procedure has been performed. And what we found is that actually in those patients, there seemed to be over a year period, a slight increase in their ejection fraction. What I want to kind of clarify here is that when we talk about cardiac sympathetic denervation, we're talking essentially about partial, because we know that the middle cervical ganglia innervation remains intact, but partial disruption of efferent and afferent fibers. And so when you interrupt both the efferent fibers, that could explain some of the heterogeneity in repolarization that are not disrupted during sympathetic activation. But the afferent fibers also can be contributing to arrhythmogenesis by basically setting up a catch-22-hour cycle where the heart goes into VTVF and then the central nervous system is basically getting activated and now increasing sympathetic input even further. And so by kind of cutting off some of that information and letting the central nervous system know that, okay, everything is fine, everything is under control, you know, we have cardiac function, we have enough output, that you may actually be affecting the central nervous system input to the heart that essentially most of the time just keeps activating the sympathetic input in a sort of a persistent fashion as soon as it detects an abnormality.
I think the issue of the afferent innervation is very interesting, perhaps less discussed and less considered than what the efferent aspects are in the field of denervation. Is that impression correct? Is much known about this idea that the afferents are contributing to arrhythmogenesis?
It's definitely known that the sensory fibers through the dorsal root ganglia, for example, if interrupted during VT or massive pacing, will tone down the sympathetic efferent output. Those were studies that were pretty old. They were done by Peter Schwartz and others in the past, and Dr. Maliani, actually.
Interesting. Crystal, we are talking about changes in action potential duration upon stimulation, and I wonder if you would give a word on what would be those cellular mechanisms for that change in action potential duration.
Thanks for that question, Mario. So in terms of cellular mechanisms in response to sympathetic activation that may be playing a role in action potential duration, we know that beta adrenergic stimulation leads to phosphorylation of several targets, including the L-type calcium channel, the potassium channels, and several calcium handling proteins. Two of the major players that we think about in terms of action potential duration, though, are often an increase in L-type calcium current, which would actually be expected to prolong the action potential duration. But typically during beta adrenergic stimulation, that increase in L-type current is actually counterbalanced by an increase in IKS current, which tends to shorten the action potential duration. So oftentimes during beta adrenergic stimulation, we do get a global shortening of action potential duration, which makes sense because the action potential needs to shorten to accommodate faster heart rates during sympathetic stimulation. However, during pathological conditions and after remodeling, which may occur in cardiomyopathy or after myocardial infarction, those currents themselves tend to be remodeled, and the response to beta adrenergic stimulation can also be remodeled. So the balance between depolarizing and hyperpolarizing currents can be shifted, in which case, in some cases, beta adrenergic stimulation can actually lead to prolongation of the action potential duration, which you can imagine could even increase dispersion of repolarization and this degree of heterogeneity.
A question that I would like to ask you, Marmar, is, has this study changed your approach to patient, or do you think there is an increased reason for giving additional consideration to the possibility of doing a sympathetic denervation in patients after MI or perhaps under other conditions?
I think absolutely. I think what this study has shown us is, first of all, it's mitigated a lot of the concerns that many physicians had about disrupting some of these efferent sympathetic fibers and whether heart failure conditions would get worse or patients would experience acute hemodynamic instability as a result of not having that sympathetic input. I think the second thing that it has opened up the doors to potentially is whether cardiac sympathetic denervation can be used not just for arrhythmias, but for heart failure, where we know there is a sympathetically activated state and a bit of a catch-22, and where we are basically throwing everything we can, including beta blockers, angiotensin receptor antagonists, at the sympathetic nervous system to try to block it as much as possible, with the caveat that we know that most of our medications have a variable effect in terms of the time you take the medicine, what its half-life is, and so on and so forth. So this procedure could represent a more permanent way of disrupting some of that sympathetic activation, both in its efferent and afferent input. And then I think the next steps would be to really evaluate whether this could be a beneficial procedure, not just for arrhythmias, but in the setting of heart failure.
For me, the real take-home message is the concept of denervation. When clinicians are performing these procedures, they're really removing the stellates and leaving the middle cervical ganglia intact. And I think this is really important. So essentially, it's more of a partial denervation or almost a pruning of sympathetic inputs rather than total denervation. And for me, one of the really key findings in this study is that with the middle cervical ganglia intact, there is still good heart rate and blood pressure control.
Well, I think that with this, we can wrap it up. I want to thank Marmar for her contribution to AJP, for a wonderful paper, and for her generosity in giving us her time and words in this conversation. And I do the same for Crystal. Thank you for acting as an expert in this process. And thank you all for being a part of the AJP process.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.